Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
There's what's actually happening with prices, and then there's what we think is going to happen. Economists care about both. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, February 14th. Good to have you with us. There's a reason we talk a lot about the mood of the American consumer on this program, because how folks are feeling can affect how they're spending, which we know is what mostly powers the U.S. economy. Lately, inflation has been weighing on our collective mood. The University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index just fell to its lowest level in a decade, depressed not just by actual inflation, but by people's expectations about where prices will go in the future. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, some new data out today from the New York Fed looks a little rosier.
As inflation has shot up to a 40-year high, consumer sentiment has tanked.
Consumers tend to forecast with what I would call a very short ruler.
Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics says this is driven by consumers' direct experience of grocery shopping or car shopping or gassing up.
Generally, consumers react very, very quickly. You know, I went to the gas station paying $50 to fill my gas tank, paid $45 last week. Therefore, inflation is going to be very high.
But the New York Federal Reserve now finds that our longer-term inflation expectations aren't so dire. Consumers predict inflation will be 3.5%, less than half of what it is now, 3 years out. Giorgio Toppa on the New York Fed's research team says consumers seem to understand that the pandemic, with its massively messed up global supply chains, has been an unusual period.
They are viewing the inflation experience differently now during the pandemic, and so they don't view it as particularly long-lasting.
Meanwhile, Americans are very confident, more than before the pandemic, about jobs and wages, says economist Eric Lund at the Conference Board. That's as labor shortages continue.
So that means wages are going to continue to rise at above pre-pandemic rates in 2023 and beyond.
If higher inflation expectations do stick around long term, that could be a big problem. But that's likely to take a while. By the time inflation peaked above 14% in the early 1980s, Americans had already lived through two decades of really high inflation. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As we just heard, one place where people are especially feeling inflation is at the gas pump. AAA says the national average price of a gallon of regular is up 18 cents from a month ago to $3.49. Fears of a Russian invasion of Ukraine have helped push oil futures to a seven-year high, around $95 a barrel. Over the weekend, President Biden warned Russian President Vladimir Putin that the U.S. and its allies would impose swift and severe costs on Russia if it invades its neighbor. As diplomatic efforts continue, Marketplace's Justin Ho has more on how the energy markets are reacting.
If the U.S. and its allies were to impose sanctions, the fear is over what Russia might do next, says Tom Tsang at the University of Tulsa.
The fear of any interruption of oil anywhere in the globe right now is pushing prices higher.
Russia is the world's third largest oil producer, and in theory, it could raise prices for its oil and gas exports. It could also divert exports away from Western Europe, which relies heavily on Russia for natural gas, says Matt Smith at the data and analytics firm Kepler.
Really, Russia has been holding Europe over a barrel because they know how much that continent is dependent upon their energy flows.
It's true that Russia's economy is dependent on selling that energy. Smith says that's why Russia can only push its leverage so far. But that's not much comfort to the oil market right now, says Sarah Vakshuri, president of SVB Energy International.
The market is very sensitive to any factor that could interrupt the supplies because the market is already tight.
Because the global economy has been reopening after the pandemic lockdowns, and many parts of the world have had a cold winter. Patrick DeHaan is head of petroleum analysis for GasBuddy. He says oil producers are struggling to keep up.
Demand for oil is up, but production has lagged behind. And so the whole global balance between supply and demand is a bit out of whack now.
Regardless of these geopolitical tensions, DeHaan says oil prices are likely to keep rising, especially as the driving season kicks off this spring. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, another down day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Traffic is finally flowing again on the Ambassador Bridge, connecting Detroit with the Canadian province of Ontario. Protesters angry about vaccine mandates in Canada had managed to block the bridge for much of the last week, cutting off a critical crossing that carries about one quarter of all the goods traded between the U.S. and Canada. That's a heck of a lot of commerce depending on a single bridge. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has that one.
The fact that so much U.S.-Canada trade is concentrated on the Ambassador Bridge made it the perfect target, says cross-border trade attorney Dan Yusko.
If you want to shut down the Canada-U.S. economy, that's where you do it.
The bridge is vulnerable for several reasons. For one thing, it's almost a century old. It can back up in bad weather. And Yusko says 9/11 sparked fears that the bridge could be a target for terrorists.
There have been folks, myself included, but a number of others that are kind of the Canada-U.S. border nerds, if you will, that have been working on what do we do to enhance our border infrastructure.
One of those enhancements is a new bridge under construction to connect Detroit and Windsor. It hasn't been easy. The U.S. and Canada spent years wrangling with the American family that owns the Ambassador Bridge. You heard right. It's public infrastructure, but it's privately owned.
I'm still not used to the idea.
That's Flavio Volpe, president of the Automotive Parts Manufacturers Association in Canada. He estimates damage from the recent blockade cost his industry alone more than $1 billion.
We all know that you're vulnerable to a closure on that bridge. We didn't know that we were vulnerable to a few dozen idiots, that it would cause such a crisis.
The last week was another wake-up call, says Laurie Tenuse of the University of Windsor's Cross-Border Institute.
Going forward, we're going to see companies say, all right, we need a different plan in the event something like this were to happen again.
As they brace for that new bridge to open up as early as 2024. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
When all the counting is done, more than 100 million people likely tuned into the Super Bowl last night, and there was plenty to take in. The hip-hop nostalgia fest that was the halftime show, Eminem taking a knee, that weird Uber Eats ad. Oh, and the football. Sorry, Cincinnati. Now that the season is over, the biggest story in professional football is a federal lawsuit against the NFL alleging a pattern of discrimination against black coaches. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
70% of NFL players are black, but only 16% of the league's general managers are, and just 6% of its head coaches.
What we're seeing in NFL is the equivalent of if we had 80% to 90% of the coaches in the National Hockey League being African-American.
That's Kenneth Shropshire. He runs the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University, and he wrote the book In Black and White, Race and Sports in America. Now, people have known for a long time that minorities have a steep hill to climb to get ahead in NFL management. It's according to Jason Belzer. He's an attorney and coach's agent.
We have always known that until somebody stepped up with a smoking gun and said, hey, I have actual proof that the system is rigged against me, nothing was going to change.
Former Miami Dolphins head coach Brian Flores thinks he has that proof. Flores got a text from his former boss, Bill Belichick, congratulating him on getting the job as the New York Giants' new head coach. But Flores' interview wasn't for another 3 days. Turns out Belichick thought he was texting Brian Daboll, who is white, and ended up getting the job. Flores told CNN that he went ahead with the interview anyway, but wondered whether there was any point.
You know, is this real? Is this, am I wasting my time?
The NFL has known for a while that its teams don't hire enough minority coaches. The league tried to fix the problem in 2003 with the Rooney Rule. That's named after the late Dan Rooney, who owned the Pittsburgh Steelers and was the chairman of the NFL's diversity committee. The rule says any team seeking a head coach has to interview at least one non-white candidate. Nellie Drew is a professor of sports law at the University of Buffalo. She says the league's numbers speak for themselves.
The Rooney Rule, as well-intentioned as it might have been, apparently is not working, and that's a problem.
In the lawsuit, Flores claims that Rooney Rule interviews are a sham, just teams checking boxes. Kenneth Shropshire in Arizona State says by filing suit, Flores is taking a huge risk.
You have somebody who's in the prime of his career that steps up and says, this is what's going on. I am going to probably sacrifice my career to try to move the needle forward on this issue of not hiring black men in the National Football League as head coaches.
Shropshire says the problem starts at the top. There is one black team president in the league. Only two of the 32 franchises are owned by people of color. Zero of them are black. In the lawsuit, Flores suggests the NFL seek black investors to become potential NFL team owners. Maureen Weston, a sports law professor at Pepperdine, says every organization can benefit from more diverse ownership.
The ability to invest in an inclusive community reflective of fans, of reflective of the players, it's just way too long that we've just accepted that this is the way things are.
The NFL says Flores' lawsuit is without merit. Over the next few months, the league will likely file a motion to dismiss the suit or go to arbitration, says Mike McCann. He's a law professor at the University of New Hampshire. But if the judge doesn't grant either request?
At that point, it really becomes a threat to the NFL, because then we go into pretrial discovery where records have to be turned over, emails, texts. Owners, general managers might have to testify under oath, at least in sworn testimony.
McCann says at that point, the NFL might decide to settle out of court. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
If you don't have enough inventory, then your prices go up.
Yeah, that's usually how it goes. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 171 points, nearly 0.5%, to close at 34,566. The NASDAQ shaved less than a point, staying flat, to land at 13,790. And the S&P 500 lost 16 points, 0.3%, to end at 4,401. We heard from Justin Ho that oil's been trading near $100 a barrel lately, in part because of the tensions between Russia and Ukraine. Looking at some oil stocks, Chevron and ExxonMobil stalled 1.5%. ConocoPhillips ran down 2%. It is Valentine's Day, one of the biggest days for candy, jewelry, and flower sales. According to the National Retail Federation, people planned to spend $23.9 billion this year on the holiday. That's just over $175 per person, about 10 bucks more than people shelled out in 2021. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.98%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Black Americans make up about 14% of the U.S. population, but according to census data, just over 2% of businesses have black owners. One reason is unequal access to capital. Terrence Dixon has been on a mission to help close that gap by mentoring fellow black entrepreneurs. He's also the longtime owner of Terra Cafe, a restaurant in Baltimore's Charles Village neighborhood. Last time we spoke, he had finally secured a loan from the Federal Paycheck Protection Program after initially being turned down. We checked in to see how he's doing now. Hey, Terrence, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Peace. Good afternoon. How are you?
Doing well. Can't complain. So how's business?
Business is awesome.
Really?
Well, you know, when I say awesome, guess what? The lights are still on. Okay. We still got our spirit up. We're recording a win every now and then, but we're definitely taking some lumps out here.
Trying to stay positive, though, it sounds like.
Hey, you got to be. You got to be.
So the last time we talked, oh gosh, it's been more than a year, and I think no one thought we would still be here with the pandemic, you know, keeping people at home, mask mandates still in place in many cities. How have you adapted?
I tell you what, it's been very challenging. One of the things is that, you know, we started with the Jerk Garden. You opened up with me on that last time, and that was phenomenal.
Yeah, that's your outdoor
space. The outdoor space, yeah. I mean, we had jazz every Monday night. It was a place where people could really release this COVID fatigue, which is, I think, plaguing everybody right now. I think everybody's just tired of this. But with everything else going on with the weather, that was like 86 real quick. You know, we started hitting down to those 10 degrees and those freezings. And you just couldn't do it outside, so I had to bring it back inside.
I want to ask you about inflation, because everybody who, you know, buys food knows that prices have been going up. How is that affecting your business, and how are you adjusting?
Well, I'll tell you what, like Fat Joe said, yesterday's prices is definitely not today's prices. You know what I mean? Let me give you a little quick one, two, three. Labor costs has definitely almost doubled, okay? We've had to go up with completely new concepts of how to pay people. No longer will the tip be sufficient. Even with the gratuity, there's a lot of downtime. You know, you can't have somebody come spend all day with you and they go home with $10. It just doesn't work. And then our food costs are just ridiculous. Because of shipping and because of other things and gouging, you know, a case of chicken wings that last year cost $42 is now $190. A case of cups that cost $30 are $85. And it's not only that the prices are high, because of the shortage, if you get them, you don't have a choice. You don't have to just take the hit one time. You better get two cases because you don't know when you're going to get another shot of them.
Or if prices are going to go up even more. Right?
Yeah. This is really strengthened a lot of people, but yet it has crushed some communities. You know, if you're here in Baltimore, you know the diversity. For some reason or other, you see how small businesses are closing left and right. And one of the things that I notice right now is that not only small business, but you have like Subways, you have 7-Elevens, they're closing. So when you have major franchises that, you know, just a whole lot of controls in there to make them awesome and they're closing, that's really like kind of like a report card of what's going on here in the city right now.
Have you at any point thought you might have to close?
Never.
Hmm.
Never. If I have to cut back and we sell one fish sub a day, we're going to keep it going. Because, see, it's bigger than a restaurant here at Terra Cafe. You know, it's just not McDonald's. We're not passing burgers across the counter. What we stand for here is Black Awesome. And understand, Terra Cafe hasn't been here just by being a star. We've been here for over 12 years right now because of the scars, you know. We've taken the licks and we've gotten back up and we've stood strong.
Before I let you go, I got to ask you what's on the menu today.
I knew you were going to do it. You know what we've been really pushing is what's, you know, we have the most awesome fish sub in the world. It is a swai that is seasoned and fried to perfection, 100% canola oil, zero, all right, zero trans fat, okay. And with a special chipotle mayo and a toasted ciabatta roll, delicious. That's the hitter for the day.
All right, Terrence. Terrence Dixon, owner of Terra Cafe in Baltimore and also Terra Loft Consulting. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you so much.
There aren't many parts of the country where affordable housing isn't a challenge right now. In Reno, Nevada, renters have been feeling it for a long time. While the local economy has been growing rapidly, new housing hasn't kept up, and a developer has been buying up huge chunks of land downtown and tearing down one source of housing for people with very low incomes, weekly motels. Bert Johnson of the Mountain West News Bureau has more.
For decades, Reno's weekly motels have been an informal safety net for low-income residents. The city says code violations for things like non-working smoke detectors and improperly sealed doorways at motels are common. But the motels are often the last stop before homelessness. Dante Martin says he used to stay in those motels until he lost his job and ended up on the street.
It's better to be in shelter than out here in the elements. Way better.
But on Reno's west side, weekly motels are being flattened to make way for an ambitious redevelopment plan. Martin says he doesn't like seeing them torn down.
My opinion is it takes everybody's like low-income place where they used to live away.
Officials who support the removal of the old motels say many of them are dilapidated and unsafe, and that they were never meant to be long-term housing. Jeff Jacobs is the developer behind the billion-dollar mixed-use project that'll replace them. It's called the Neon Line District.
We want to do a non-gaming hotel. We want to do a zip line across the over the sculptures, Reno's Neon Zip Line. We've already trademarked that.
The development will bring entertainment, retail, and up to 3,000 units of market-rate housing. Jacob says losing those motels will be worth it in the long run because his project will revitalize the area. And he's offered to donate land to the Reno Housing Authority where more than 800 apartments could be built. But housing advocates like Megan Archambault say the Neon Line project is displacing low-income people now who don't have other alternatives.
A lot of these motels were almost kind of way stations for people.
Archambault started a Facebook group during the pandemic to help people in the Reno area who might be displaced. She says many motel residents use the Reno Sparks Mutual Aid Facebook page for help buying groceries or making rent. But they've been dropping off as more motels come down. She says she wants to see the motels remodeled, not removed. Brian Bonenfant says Reno's affordability crisis goes a lot deeper than a few motels.
If you don't have enough inventory, then your prices go up. And then people at the very low end of the spectrum get priced out.
Bonenfant is a housing expert at the University of Nevada, Reno. He says Reno's housing crisis began in 2014 when the state gave Tesla a $1.2 billion incentive package to open a new factory east of town. Dozens of tech and manufacturing companies followed. And during that time, the average rent nearly doubled from about $900 a month to more than $1,600.
As we go into more of this high tech world, we're leaving people behind.
Bonenfant says the only long-term solution to the crunch is to build more housing. A few miles south of the Neon Line site, a new apartment complex is taking shape. Roxanne DiCarlo is executive director for the Empowerment Center, which is building the project.
Right outside of this rear entrance will be a nice large patio, and so we plan on having benches and a couple barbecues.
These won't be luxury condos. They'll be reserved for low-income people. The first phase will add 42 units to the city's rental stock. DiCarlo says they wouldn't be building anything without federal subsidies. Back downtown, Chris Cox and his brother Ronald live in a weekly motel. Both are on permanent disability. They pay $950 a month for their room.
The walls are filthy. They didn't bother to clean it.
But the Cox brothers say it's all they can afford. And Dante Martin, who'd been living unsheltered for months, decided to leave Reno after 8 years. He's moved to Washington State, where he says he now has a job. In Reno, I'm Bert Johnson for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. I had a feeling when I saw that QR code ad last night, I'd be talking about it on the show today. If you missed it, the commercial was just 60 seconds of black screen with a QR code bouncing around like a screensaver. Millions of people apparently took the bait, scanned the code, and crashed the website. Maybe not quite the buzz Coinbase, the cryptocurrency platform behind the ad, had in mind. Okay, we are out of here, but here's your moment of economic context. One more thing about ads. This year, a 30-second spot in the Super Bowl went for about $6.5 million, which is a lot to pay for something a lot of people just tune out. Researchers at Cornell University tracked the eye movements of TV viewers in more than 1,000 households over the course of a year. They found that 30% of commercials played to empty rooms. And when people were present, they often changed the channel or switched their attention to that second screen. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.